Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Gillian Jones-Williams. Gillian is an MD, entrepreneur, author, award-winning business leader, motivational speaker, diversity strategist, and master executive coach. Gillian, who started work at 16, founded the Emerge Development Consultancy over 30 years ago, and in 2024 won Businesswoman of the Decade in the UK's Best Businesswomen's Award. Her business focuses largely on helping companies with diversity and inclusion, including programs to support those from diverse backgrounds. Gillian is very proud of her award-winning transformational women's development program, RISE, which has trained over 3,000 women across the UK and internationally. Gillian says, just seeing women go through this and changing their lives, helping them with the technique to get rid of their limiting beliefs and really achieve it, just makes my heart sing. Gillian Jones-Williams, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlotte. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Well, we had such a fascinating conversation when I interviewed you for We Need New Leaders. I just had to have you back on the pod. And I'd love to talk about the fact that you left school at 16 and you've built this amazing career for yourself. Has this been a process of addressing your own limiting beliefs?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, I didn't have a traditional start to life or to my career. My mother was chronically bipolar, which is something that isn't still talked about so much in business. We talk a lot more about neurodiversity, but not necessarily bipolar, which is why I left school at 16. I had to go and get a job. I'd also discovered I'd inherited a low grade of bipolar, which I only really started talking about 5 years ago. So the whole of my career has been, on the whole, masking it. I discovered I had ADHD last year when I was diagnosed as that, which comes with something called RSD, which is rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which means that I am absolutely struggling on most days with rejection, limiting beliefs and other things, so that really inhibit how I feel about myself. So yes, long answer to short question, but yeah, I think that's why it's so important for me to help other people to get rid of their limiting beliefs.
And with that, could you tell us a little bit about the program and how it helps women acknowledge that they have limiting beliefs and deal with them?
Absolutely. I think that every single woman and men, but let's talk about women for now, has a limiting belief in their head coming from the voices in their heads. And when I ask people who has a voice in their head, the majority of them, 99%, will go, yes, I have one. And then that 1%, I'll say that was probably the voice in your head which said, no, I don't have one. They've maybe not met it properly yet or spoken to it. And those voices can sometimes be constructive, but more often are destructive. And, you know, it leads to imposter syndrome. So this is really the root cause of imposter syndrome, whereas people are put into roles and they think that they're still not good enough. So even though other people around them are believing that they have the talent and they have everything it needs, they still don't believe it themselves and battle with imposter syndrome. So it's rife out there.
Yeah, I understand that you're going to also be offering rise to men. Is that the case?
We are, yes. It's something that we have done. We have offered rise before to men. However, what we do with rise is we like to offer a really safe space for women to become vulnerable and to be able to talk about issues affecting them. So it's not a leadership program per se, although the results of it are that many women go on and progress more in their careers and are more successful. But we've recently looked at the narrative around men. We've looked at some of the issues facing men and recognized that they need their own space, sometimes to learn to be vulnerable or to be vulnerable and discuss how they are feeling. And, you know, there's so much talk of toxic masculinity. We want to really help them with positive masculinity and also help them to understand how to be allies to women as well.
And does the topic of neurodiversity come up as well in these workshops?
A lot of the time. It's amazing how many people haven't necessarily even been diagnosed. But when we start to talk about it, we'll say, actually, this is ringing so many bells with me and making me think about myself. And they may then go and get diagnosed. But my experience recently has been that, well, there feels like there's becoming more people who are neurodiverse than who are neurotypical in the workplace. And perhaps we've been building this neurotypical world, which suddenly people think, that's why I've always felt a bit different, or that's why I've always felt it's more difficult to operate than, you know, it might have been in previous years when nobody wanted to talk about it.
It's so interesting that opening the space for discussion allows people to start recognize things in themselves. And then it starts to become clear we're all potentially on the spectrum somewhere.
Yeah, and it's such a broad topic. One of the things which is really important to me, when people do have neurodiversity, that they feel comfortable and able to describe it in a positive way. And so often when I start coaching with somebody, they may say, I'm not very good at this because I'm autistic, or I'm not very good at this because I have ADHD. And, you know, by the end of it, what I want them to be saying is, I am brilliant at doing this, and it's because I'm autistic, or it's because I have ADHD. That's something I think that for people to really think about is, how does it become your superpower? You know, there are things which are more difficult for you to do. However, let's put what you can do best first.
Yeah, I love that so much, that reframing, which is also about changing those, it matches the limiting beliefs shift as well.
Yeah. And it helps to kind of flip the narrative, doesn't it, from this is holding me back. Because, you know, in my career, I know I've been so lucky to have the most amazing team. Some of them have been with me, well, almost for the whole 30 years. And I didn't realize until I had my diagnosis that I had surrounded myself with people who can do all the things that I'm not particularly good at and make sure I'm in the right place at the right time with everything that I need, and, you know, couldn't do it without them.
Yeah. And I remember you saying in the interview for We Need New Leaders, yeah, that businesses are starting to recognize the superpowers of people with ADHD and people on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
But there isn't yet a comfortable discussion about bipolar disorder. How do you talk about that?
Well, I think it's due to probably a lack of knowledge. And what people don't really understand about bipolar is that there are three different grades. There's cyclothemia, which is what I have, which is very low grade, which means you live your life in ups and downs. Then there is grade two, which my son was diagnosed with last year, which means you have more depressive episodes as well as being very, very creative. And then there's grade one, which is what my mother had, which is a very serious one. And that's where people have episodes, have suicide attempts. And that's what the news and television programs tend to depict when they have a character who has bipolar. It's somebody who is the extreme of that. And it's quite a correct description in some ways of somebody who is grade one with bipolar. But there are many, many people who have lower grades who are, you know, functioning quite normally at work on medication. Since my son had medication, he runs his own business. He's a photographer and videographer in the music industry, highly creative, as many people with bipolar are. And the medication just helps to stabilize. Neither of us have ever had an episode, never missed a day off work because of it. But I always felt that if I'd said that to people, they would have been a little bit scared or a bit concerned. And I can imagine that if somebody was applying to a big organization for a role and declared it, that in the past, certainly people have thought, you know, it's a bit of a risk. What if?
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your leadership style. You've been running your business for 30 years. How has your leadership journey changed over the years?
I guess bearing in mind what we've just been talking about, I've tried very hard to become less chaotic. So I've always been very entrepreneurial. And again, as you start to understand more things, and I would come in, I think like a hurricane, and I've had this idea and I've had that idea and we could do this and we could do that and the other. And my team would sit with me and go, Gillian, do you think we could just start one thing and finish it? So I've had to learn over the years very much that my excitement, and particularly if I go into hyper-focus in ADHD and I can really, you know, go crazy with lots of ideas, that, you know, if I want to have people around me who are going to help to implement and do that, then I've got to understand how they like to work and I've got to deliver my information and my ideas in that way to them. And that's how we've really learnt to work together. But I think for a long period of time when I first started working, they were probably exhausted by, you know, me coming in going, oh, I've just been thinking. I think those words used to put dread into the, oh my God, she's been thinking again. Oh no, you know, what now? But I think that the biggest change that I've made is that for so many years, I struggled with delegation. And that probably is all linked, because having these big ideas, I was thinking, well, how will anybody else understand that or do anything? But now I've become very, very good at delegation, and that makes a massive difference. And, you know, that means really trusting people. And, you know, the irony is, and I talk to this a lot about delegating as a leader, we think, well, nobody will do it the same way as I will do it. And it's really hard to give it to them. No, actually, they do it better. It's just, you know, your head which goes, yes, but that's not how I would do it.
Yeah, I can see that it's been a learning journey for you, which is wonderful. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit now about diversity and inclusion. So we're living at a time where in some parts of the world, DEI and programs are being squeezed, if not even removed. But we all know we need them more than ever. And how does your work help organizations shift the needle on their diversity and inclusion goals?
Yeah, I think, you know, without getting too political, you're absolutely right. It's a very different landscape this year than it has been before, because obviously, you know, organizations were really pushing ahead with DEI initiatives. We have always called that part of our business inclusive cultures. And we've always believed that, for example, that DEI doesn't really stand alone. It should be themed through every leadership program. And it should be a real kind of golden thread in the business rather than too many standalone initiatives. And I think the change has been is that some organizations are quite confused at the moment, particularly if they have parents, US parents and things like that, about what to do about it. They don't want to stop it, but they're kind of concerned, and perhaps they're trying to hide it now, which is something that we don't really want to be part of, because, you know, the people who need the support are people who've probably hid their characteristics for so many years. So we're trying to work with organizations to help them to understand that completely dismissing the DEI agenda is going to be very detrimental to business. There have been, I think, in the past, some well-intentioned but maybe slightly misplaced initiatives which, yeah, possibly it's a good time to, let's just pause and review, have they been what was needed? And to think more about how do we create cultures of psychological safety, particularly how do leaders create cultures of psychological safety? How do we make it that people all feel comfortable having conversations, but also feel comfortable in conflict and having slightly more difficult conversations? Radical candor, I think it's called, isn't it?
Yes, I was. That was the thought bubble that was coming up in my head as you were speaking, which is that idea of we're safe enough to disagree.
Yes, exactly that.
And safe enough that we can have conversations that make us feel slightly uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that is really changing cultures, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, for a long time, what happened was people became so scared that they couldn't say anything at all. And that meant that there was very stilted conversations going on and that people weren't conversing in the right way. So, as you said, helping people to know that if they're curious and sincere in their questioning, if they do slightly get it wrong, you know, being able to apologize and to understand and say, thank you for telling me, is the way forward. Because otherwise, you know, organizations will get to a place where environments are so sterile that everybody's afraid to say anything to anyone.
Yes, and I think that's part of the backlash, is that people felt stifled and felt so much fear that they couldn't even address issues.
Yeah.
And so I think having slightly awkward, uncomfortable conversations is so much healthier than having perfect, polished conversations.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about privilege during the interview for We Need New Leaders, because you came originally from a working class background, but you've built a large business yourself. So you said to me then, you feel that you now live in privilege because of the contacts you've built.
Yeah.
And in this world of diversity, inclusion, neurodiversity, I think we can't avoid talking about privilege. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people I talk to get quite heightened by the word privilege. And certainly during hashtag Black Lives Matter, that word privilege would cause a lot of debate and discussion. And I think if we looked at privileges as advantages, you know, you're either born with advantages or you gain advantages through your life. You know, I'm very tall, so I have the advantage I can reach up to big shelves. It's not always an advantage, not when I'm sitting in plane seats. And other people don't have that advantage. So, you know, when you start looking at other types of privilege, like, as you mentioned, socioeconomic, no, I wasn't born to a house that had a lot of money. I wasn't able to go to college or university. But through my life, I've had the ability to study, to learn, to build a big network. So I feel like I can now help other people. So I would say I feel privileged now. And I talk to lots of people from different diversities with different characteristics, who somebody from the same part of the world or something like that might say, oh, you know, I don't feel I have as much privilege as other people. And they may say I have more. So I think the thing is, we can't blanket everybody with the same thing, but it's about just understanding and leaning into that privilege and thinking, well, what can I do with it? And if we could think about it in that way, rather than thinking, oh, I've been labelled as somebody with privilege, then we can put it to positive use.
I think it goes back to that point about fearful conversations and inclusive conversations, that having certain types of privilege, whatever they might be, doesn't make you a bad person.
Yeah.
And having an awareness of whatever advantages you may or may not have had helps you have inclusive conversations.
Yeah. Yes, that's it. And, you know, when you understand where your privilege has come from and why you have privilege, then it's much easier to look around and think, who is there I can help? And it's about being able to do it in a way that doesn't feel patronizing, condescending to other people. But there's lots of stats around and facts about women, men, women of different race in the workplace, about how they do need help. And there are things that are important to them and that they do need to be supported with. So we need to take notice of those stats and think about what can we do on a daily basis to do it. So I think, for example, there's a stat about how much women get overtalked at meetings. Yeah. And, you know, it just takes a really good ally to just stand up and say, hang on a second, I don't think Charlotte's finished. Or wasn't that Charlotte's idea? Shall we hear more from her? And so it can be very, very small things. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to be major gestures or things like that. I mean, those can be very helpful too, but it can be on a daily basis.
I love that. Thank you so much. Gillian, a slight shift now. You've won awards, you've written books, you're a well-known figure in your industry. How do you think about your own reputation?
It's like when you introduced me and it was like Businesswoman of the Decade and things like that. I'm probably like every other normal person. Don't take much time to stop and celebrate these things. And, you know, when I hear it back like that, I think, oh, yes, I've done quite a lot, really, haven't I, like that. So I don't think I necessarily lean into thinking, wow, that's me. And it's probably because my brain is too busy thinking, yes, but what's next and what else can we do? I'm very, very proud of our organisation. But I still, as I said, have to really underline that that is due to the wonderful people who work in it, you know, because my ideas and my thoughts are nothing, would be nothing without them making things actually happen. Yes, it does sound like a lot, doesn't it? And I suppose I'm entering the autumn of my career, shall we say, now. And I probably am reflecting more and thinking about where we were and where we've got to. You know, we're very, very lucky here that the first client I ever got is still our biggest client now. They're a very big organisation and they were our first client 30 years ago. They're still our biggest client now. So we have also tremendous client loyalty. And which this is my ADH brain going, that wasn't the question Charlotte asked.
But it's a lovely story. Gillian, tell me about your books and what role these have played for you.
Yes, my first book, well, my first book was an accident, and that's because 30 years ago, there was not very much one-to-one coaching, and we used to do face-to-face training, and when clients said to me, could you do a one-to-one with somebody, they're like, well, we do it with groups, it can't be that different. And so when I started coaching, and I'd come away from a coaching session, I'd think to myself, okay, so we got here. How did we do that? And I started writing down the process. And I thought it might be something to share with other coaches around. Until in the end, I had this whole kind of folder of things that I'd written down, like when somebody had a career issue, when somebody had a conflict. And I like turning things into models, and I like finding acronyms and things like that. So I had that in a book and I thought at some time, maybe that's something to sell, you know, you never know. So I became one of the, I suppose, earlier adopters of coaching before there was much rigor and before the awarding bodies really had, you know, identified how to accredit people. But then I started to write the other book, which was How to Create a Coaching Culture. And this is based on case studies of clients because we were starting to work with clients to empower them and to help the organizations to become much more of a learning organization. And we were at a exhibition one day and my publishers came along and I said, oh, that's interesting. I've written a couple of books and I've got this book on how to create a coaching culture. And they had a look and they went, yeah, I don't think the world's ready for that. And they said, what's this one? I said, oh, this is just tools for coaching. And they said, oh, now that's interesting. So they took that and they published it in 2009. And this year we're now writing the sixth edition of it. So we just add new tools and Of course, they're on neurodiversity this year, and they're also on AI and more team coaching. So we're looking at different. I co-write this with a wonderful lady, Rogarella, in Australia. And then a few years later, they just came back and said, didn't you have a book on coaching culture? And we said, yeah, it's kind of sitting there getting dusty. And they said, oh, well, we'd like to publish that one now. So that's how it happened, again, very much by accident. But the last book that I wrote, that's before the one I'm writing now, was during lockdown. And this was because I was one of the people who was at risk, and so I really couldn't go out anywhere. Our business was doing incredibly well, and on the 23rd of March 2020, we lost everything. We just sat there and watched our entire order book disappear. You know, we had probably the biggest order book we'd ever seen for advance orders in there. And so we watched it all disappear, and we had to reinvent the business. We had to really fight to understand how we were going to save the business. So I started to write a book. I think there's a theme here. Writing is one of the things I do. And I wrote a diary of lockdown. And every single day, I wrote everything that happened in the world. I wrote through the Prime Minister's briefings or whoever was doing the briefing and my fight to save the business. And when I read it back now, it's like a fairy story. It's like, no, we didn't really go and stand like that and do that, did we? So, and I wrote that to raise money for the bereaved families of the NHS because I couldn't do anything else. I was stuck at home. I couldn't go and help anywhere or support anyone.
And how did COVID then change your business?
Completely changed. We were just saying that this morning, early this morning, we were doing a kickoff of a program, which is a virtual program, with people from every destination you could think of. And whilst it was the most terrible time for us, it finally allowed us to become a much more global organization and to do business very, very differently. Not without challenges. I wasn't a particularly technological person. I've become much better at things like that. And oh, it's terrifying. Those first few weeks of running courses on Zoom and locking myself out of meetings and leaving people in breakout rooms, and just like big learning curve.
Yes, we've all had to learn for sure. So, Gillian, we've talked about changing mindsets, we've talked about reframing, we've talked about having difficult conversations and being open to what others have to say, and trying so hard not to be so firm in our ideas about other people. And yeah, you know that my passion is to open a conversation, but also open the door for new kinds of leadership.
Yeah.
So that we break the old archetype that we have in our head of what a leader looks like. What do you think we can do both collectively and individually to change the old archetype and accept new ways of being leaders?
Well, I think that's very relevant to the conversation we've just been having about the way the world changed with hybrid and working. And although I know lots of organisations are encouraging people to come back to work, there's still a hybrid shift. What I haven't seen enough of is the leadership shift to managing hybrid teams, and still not enough emphasis placed on managing for productivity as opposed to presenteeism. And I think that nowadays, leaders really need to be able to trust people, and particularly new generations, that if they can't see them working, that they are working, or that they will achieve things. And with new generations coming through, you know, I know that certainly millennials, Gen Z, etc., if I give them a task to do, say produce a newsletter on Canva, they could probably do it in 2 hours, and it might have taken me, you know, 2 days to do. So it's about the results. And I don't know how you feel, but I still know lots of leaders who struggle with that trust of, well, you know, I called them at 12 o'clock and they weren't online. Well, maybe they did go for a walk. Maybe they started at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning. And I think if we could help leaders to do that, it would make such a difference.
Yeah, I love that. I think pointing to the pandemic as the shift that started opening our minds to this change.
Yeah.
But also recognizing that the generations following us can be extremely effective in new ways of working.
Yes.
And just learning to trust them and to follow their lead.
Absolutely. And it's also recognizing the differences that AI bring and how differently people need to learn. You know, years and years ago, we might have said, somebody needs 10 years experience in this role to be able to do that. Now, well, maybe that was true in those days when they really needed to be exposed to things in the workplace for 10 years. Nowadays, with AI, with Google, with, you know, TikTok, with everything else like that, so much can be learned so much quicker. And, you know, I look at what people can do with AI now. And again, if people are pretty savvy with that, they are going to be much faster at what they do. So what do? We think, well, you did that really quickly. Let's keep overloading you. Or perhaps to think, going back to neurodiversity, if I go into hyperfocus, which is one of the forms of ADHD, which I have, for 6 hours, I could sit and I could do something that would take somebody else 2 weeks to do. But then the next day, I might have total inattention and find it a struggle to do anything at all. Now, if you were my leader and you were giving me a performance review, I could see exactly how it would go. It would say, Gillian, if only you could be more consistent. You were brilliant on Tuesday. But the rest of the week, you know, you were a bit all over the place. So, having said that, I'm not suggesting, you know, there are certain places where people need to be more consistent. And if it's a job where you do need consistency, it's probably not the right job for somebody like me. But it's just really getting to know people and how do they perform best and what's the environment I need to create for them. And I think some leaders still don't quite recognize that their job is to get things done through people. It's almost like, you know, well, when do I get the time to do this coaching? And I say, it sounds like you're talking about this coaching, as if you've got a really busy job to do and people are giving you a side order of people to manage. Do these people have anything to do with you achieving your objectives? In which case, isn't it time you started delegating? Well, there's the pot calling the kettle black, but delegating and letting them do it and being their manager and mentor.
I love that. And what it sounds like to me is not matching the people to the work, but matching the work to the people. And that's the shift in mindset that leaders need to make.
That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah. If that's possible, I recognize not in every environment it is. But if it's not, why not think about it? Because when you have all of these talented people, you know, nobody's always going to fit a cookie cutter drop of everything. So really sitting there and thinking about who do I have and how can I maximize their talents, exactly as you said, is going to get much more of a result.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Gillian. Now move on to our three standard questions.
Yes.
Give us a book recommendation.
Just one?
You can give two.
Two. Okay. I'll give one leadership and then I'll give another one that really changed my life last year. And it has to be Brené Brown for me. I am a real fangirl of Brené Brown and her Dare to Lead, where she really does give accountability for recognizing talent and developing people. And, you know, I really love the work that she does in talking about courage and vulnerability. And I think leaders who show vulnerability have amazing results. So that would be my real book. I mean, there's so many. But the other book which really changed my life last year, and who would have thought it, was Breath by James Nestor and learning nasal breathing. Who knew that nasal breathing did so much for your mental health, your physical health, even cavities in your mouth, you know, balancing your sympathetic system and helping you. It was just a revelation to me. So I can honestly say, if nobody has thought about this or read Breath by James Nestor or listened to it, just learning to breathe through your nose has made a massive difference.
Wow.
Breath is very well researched and it has lots of case studies and lots of scientific evidence in, and even looking at the shape of mouths of people over the years. And of course it goes on to mouth taping as the ultimate. Haven't quite got to mouth taping yet.
I did give it a go. It was quite exciting. Gillian, what are your three tips for leaders who are coming through into the workplace now, who are emerging, who come from diverse backgrounds, tips for them for landing, keeping, or creating their dream leadership roles?
Yeah. I think number one, be authentic. And don't feel that, you know, if you're in an organization who doesn't appreciate the fact that you have different color hair, tattoos, styles, or you're a different race, that they're not the organization for you. So authenticity. I think also, as we said, lean into your own strengths. And that would lead to the final one, which is empower, empower, empower. And that means delegating the right amount of not just responsibility, but authority. And often managers forget that bit, to explicitly delegate the right amount of authority. And as I just said, just be a coach and mentor to your people and just watch them thrive.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you so much, Gillian. And last question, what brings you joy?
My granddaughter and my grandson.
Oh, well, of course they do.
They absolutely. That's on a private side, but the women's development brings me absolute joy, hearing from women who've broken free of some of the shackles and beliefs that have held them back for years and years and have gone on to do brilliant things. Absolutely makes my heart sing.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. And Gillian Jones-Williams, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.